Track 8, and now we come to Letters to the Editor. And the first one is from Peter Scott via email. It's been several weeks since Reform UK's strong showing in the local elections. Their popularity is clear, and their pitch, tax cuts, nationalising water and keeping the NHS free, is seductive. Their supporters are right that Britain's in a mess, but can Reform fix it? Look closer and the gloss fades. Their economic plan is Trussonomics in slow motion. Sweeping tax cuts, especially for the rich, leaving a 50 plus billion black hole. Their supposed savings from scraping net zero are fantasy. The likely result? Austerity, slash services, managed decline, and billionaires thriving. They promise deep cuts to councils already gutted by 14 years of Conservative misrule, echoing failed US DOG-style experiments that delivered chaos, not savings. Their burqa ban, meanwhile, is absurd from a party claiming to champion freedom. Will nuns' habits or bikers' helmets be next? On climate, they double down on fossil fuels as the world burns. On immigration, they plan to break international law and dump migrants on French shores. What's to stop the French doing the same to us? Then the people. Farage has a long record of opportunism and U-turns. Can we believe anything he says? Lee Anderson is best known for offensive stunts. Reform's new councillors already appear incompetent to govern. We've had a string of those who disagree with Farage being cancelled by him, the company CEO, not leader of a democratic party. Like UKIP before them, Reform's bubble may soon burst, but not before causing damage, especially if Labour chases their voters by copying their policies. That strategy already was a disaster for the Tories. Popularity and promises are easy. Competence and credibility are much harder. Reform UK are big on the former, but on fitness to govern, they have yet to score.
And from Dilys Morgan via email, Thames Water's failure demands urgent action. The record £122 million fine recently imposed on Thames Water for environmental failures is welcome, but barely scratches the surface. This is a company that has abused its monopoly position for decades. Instead of investing in infrastructure, it was privatised to improve. Thames Water borrowed heavily, amassing £19 billion in debt, while paying out huge dividends and inflating executive pay. Little of that borrowing went into pipes, reservoirs or stopping sewage spills. Now they've raised bills by 31%, seek a 53% hike and have secured a £3 billion loan, much of which will go to service debts and pay lawyers, not fix infrastructure. Their response to public outrage? Attempt to sidestep bonus caps by increasing base pay and claim their executives are the company's greatest asset. In truth, they are its greatest liability. The proposed rescue deal has collapsed. This company is, by all definitions, bust. It has failed its customers, polluted rivers, and rewarded failure with pay rises. The government must now step in, take Thames Water into special administration, and remove those responsible without reward. Enough is enough. Meanwhile, Labour's Steve Reed has ruled out public ownership for the industry, citing a £100 billion cost figure from a discredited 2018 industry-funded report. More credible estimates, like Moody's, put the cost nearer £15 billion. Most of the world's water is publicly owned. UK privatisation has failed. Labour's refusal to consider nationalisation in the Cunningham-Cliff review defies logic and alienates supporters. Their reasons for that refusal do not stand up.
Penny King from Crediton writes, Like everyone who has some contact with modern life, I hear and read and see in the media the relentless, conflicting and varied noise around climate change, and sometimes it just makes me tired. There are numerous well-respected, independent scientific bodies throughout the world whose evidence-based information we largely trust enough to take into account when making decisions in many areas of our life, including public health and disease, weather forecasting, technology, horticulture. There may be some scepticism or questioning of detail, but largely, if the evidence is compelling, we act on it. So with something that has huge implications for us humans as dangerously rising CO2 levels due to our own and our ancestors' activity, some areas of the world proportionally much more so than others, why is there so much reactive noise that seems to me to go way beyond scepticism into aggression, derision and general hostility? I am aware that, just by putting my thoughts into the public arena, some people will be labelling me and mentally relegating me into the crowded box called environmental extremist or green zealot. As we all know, deep down, this is lazy thinking and actually deflects from any meaningful debate. And of course, we need debate about how to reduce CO2 emissions. In trying to do this, we are stepping into untrodden territory. We have to create a vision of what the world might look like in a modern world, and the detail of the way net zero is achieved is debated even within the mainstream, who accept that we have to act. And it also seems to me that some, if not many, of the sceptics paint a consistently dismal picture of what they see as the consequences of pursuing a net zero policy. When I heard on the BBC News recently that the government want to bring in legislation that obliges new homes to be routinely built with solar panels, my own immediate thought was, about time too. The news report suggested that representatives of the building industry are largely positive about this plan, as long as it doesn't involve them in delays in getting on with projects due to a new red tape. In my nearest city, the council have nearly completed a systematic retrofit of all their social housing stock. I have a friend who has been a tenant in one of these houses for 30 years. Last summer, their street was done, and now she has new up-to-date cavity wall insulation and solar panels on every aspect of her roof that gets the sun at some point during the day. She's very pleased, and I suspect that most people in her position would be, even if they think climate change is a scam. This is just one small but obvious example of the positive benefits for each of us of changes of how we live our lives with the aim of reducing emissions. It's not rocket science, so why all the hostility?